You may notice that a lot of what I'm playing is percussion and voice and piano. It seems that that's pretty much all my library of John Cage has been made of, except for this one recording, which is actually my favorite one, which I'll get into a little bit later, but, you know, there's no reason to hide myself now. I love that kind of sound and let that kind of stuff. And actually, I've got John here with us. I just wanted to ask him how he feels about people that kind of hole into only one aspect of his work.
Yoga. Yoke. Taming of the globe. Open. In and out. Einstein wrote to Freud to say men should stop having wars. Freud wrote back to say if you get rid of war, you'll also get rid of love. Freud was wrong. What permits us to love one another and the earth we inhabit is that we and it are impermanent. We obsolesce. Life's everlasting. Individuals aren't. A mushroom lasts for only a very short time. Often I go in the woods thinking after all these years I ought finally to be bored with fungi. But coming upon just any mushroom in good condition, I lose my mind all over again. Supreme good fortune. We're both alive.
TV Cologne, 1958.
To divide between us belong to all of us. The land, for instance, beneath the oceans.
But John, what do you make of the people that have, let's say, misrepresented 433?
People speak of literacy. But I, for one, can't read or write any computer language. Only numbers I know are those based on 10. I'm uneducated.
Indeed. Now, my favorite John Cage piece is John Cage and David Tudor, Indeterminacy. I guess I'm going to have to open this thing up and say, well, they're in two different rooms. Cage is reading one-minute stories. David Tudor is playing electronic music. They can't hear each other. That's the indeterminate part of it. The music is fantastic. So are the stories. Let's get into some of this.
This summer, I'm going to give a class in mushroom identification at the New School for Social Research. Actually, it's 5 field trips, not really a class at all. However, when I proposed it to Dean Clara Meyer, though she was delighted with the idea, she said, "I'll have to let you know later whether or not we'll give it." So she spoke to the president, who couldn't see why there should be a class in mushrooms at the new school, Next, she spoke to Professor McIver, who lives in Piermont. She said, "What do you think about our having a mushroom class at the new school?" He said, "Fine idea. Nothing more than mushroom identification develops the powers of observation." This remark was relayed both to the president and to me. It served to get the class into the catalog and to verbalize for me my present attitude toward music. It isn't useful, music isn't, unless it develops our powers of audition. But most musicians can't hear a single sound, they listen only to the relationship between two or more sounds. Music for them has nothing to do with their powers of audition, but only to do with their powers of observing relationships. In order to do this, they have to ignore all the crying babies, fire engines, telephone bells, coughs that happen to occur during their auditions. Actually, if you run into people who are really interested in hearing sounds, you're apt to find them fascinated by the quiet ones. "Did you hear that?" they will say. In 1954, when I went to Europe, I no sooner arrived in Paris than I noticed that the city was covered with posters publicizing a mushroom exhibition that was being held in the botanical gardens. That was all I needed. Off I went. When I arrived, I found myself in a large room filled with many tables upon which were displayed many species of fungi. On the hour, from a large centrally placed loudspeaker, a recorded lecture on the deadly poisonous amanitas was delivered. During this lecture, nobody in the hall moved or spoke. Each person's attention was, so to speak, riveted to the information being given. A week later, I was in Köln, in Germany, attending a concert of electronic music. There was also an audience and a large loudspeaker. However, many in the audience were dozing off, and some were talking to their neighbors. I went to a concert upstairs in Town Hall. The composer, whose works were being performed, had provided program notes. One of these notes was to the effect that there is too much pain in the world. After the concert, I was walking along with the composer, and he was telling me how the performances had not been quite up to snuff. So I said, "Well, I enjoyed the music, but I don't agree with that program note about there being too much pain in the world." He said, "What? Don't you think there's enough?" I said, "I think there's just the right amount." In 1949, Merce Cunningham and I went to Europe on a Dutch boat. As we were approaching Rotterdam, the fog became so thick that landing was delayed. To expedite matters, the customs officials came aboard the boat. Passengers formed into lines and one by one were questioned. Merce Cunningham was in one line, I was in another. I smoke a great deal, whereas he doesn't smoke at all. However, he was taking 5 cartons of cigarettes into Europe for me, and I had that number myself. We were both traveling through Holland to Belgium and then France, and the customs regulations vary for all those countries with regard to cigarettes. For instance, you could at that time take 5 cartons per person into France, but only 2 per person into Holland. When I got to my customs officer, all of this was clear to both of us. Out of the goodness of his heart, he was reluctant to deprive me of my 3 extra cartons or to charge duty on them. But he found it difficult to find an excuse for letting me off. Finally, he said, "Are you going to go out of Holland backwards?" I said, "Yes." He was overjoyed. Then he said, "You can keep all the cigarettes. Have a good trip." I left the line and noticed that Merce Cunningham had just reached his customs officer and was having some trouble about the extra cartons. So I went over and told the official that Merce Cunningham was going to go out of Holland backwards. He was delighted. "Oh," he said, "in that case, there's no problem at all." About 10 years ago, down at Black Mountain College during a summer session, I arranged an amateur festival of the works of Erik Satie. There were altogether 25 concerts, most of them about 30 minutes long, but a few were longer. For each one, I prepared to talk about the music which was to be heard. This was necessary because most of the people there had a German point of view and the music I was presenting was French. Satie had little fondness for German music. He told Debussy, for instance, that what was needed was a music without any sauerkraut in it. And he remarked that the reason Beethoven was so well known was that he had a good publicity manager. So after about 10 of the concerts and talks, I gave a good-sized talk about music in which I denounced Beethoven. A few days later, Patsy Lynch, now Patsy Davenport, knocked on my door and said, "I think I understand what you said about Beethoven, and I think I agree. But I have a very serious question to ask you. How do you feel about Bach?" One day, I asked Schoenberg what he thought about the international situation. He said, the important thing to do is to develop foreign trade. One day while I was composing, the telephone rang. A lady's voice said, "Is this John Cage, the percussion composer?" I said, "Yes." She said, "This is the J. Walter Thompson Company." I didn't know what that was, but she explained that their business was advertising. She said, "Hold on, one of our directors wants to speak to you." During a pause, my mind went back to my composition. Then suddenly a man's voice said, "Mr. Cage, are you willing to prostitute your art?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, bring us some samples Friday at 2. I did. After hearing a few recordings, one of the directors said to me, "Wait a minute." Then 7 directors formed what looked like a football huddle. From this, one of them finally emerged, came over to me and said, "You're too good for us. We're going to save you for Robinson Crusoe." One day, down at Black Mountain College, David Tudor was eating his lunch. A student came over to his table and began asking him questions. David Tudor went on eating his lunch. The student kept on asking questions. Finally, David Tudor looked at him and said, "If you don't know, why do you ask?" There's a street in Stony Point, in a lowland near the river, where a number of species of mushrooms grow abundantly. I visit this street often. A few years ago in May, I found the morel there, a choice mushroom which is rare around Rockland County. I was delighted. None of the people living on this street ever talk to me while I'm collecting mushrooms. Sometimes children come over and kick at them before I get to them. Well, the year after I found the morel, I went back in May expecting to find it again, only to discover that a cinder block house had been put up where the mushroom had been growing. As I looked at the changed land, all the people in the neighborhood came out on their porches. One of them said, "Ha ha, your mushrooms are gone." A composer friend of mine, who spent some time in a mental rehabilitation center, was encouraged to do a good deal of bridge playing. After one game, his partner was criticizing his play of an ace on a trick which had already been won. My friend stood up and said, "If you think I came to the loony bin to learn to play bridge, you're crazy." Once I was visiting my Aunt Marge. She was doing her laundry. She turned to me and said, "You know, I love this machine much more than I do your Uncle Walter."
Those guys can't hear each other at all. Keep that in mind. 1959. We're going to come back to that. Trust me. But there's also a favorite John Cage composition of mine, which I think I'm going to play twice. I got two versions of it. It's called A Flower. It's for voice and closed piano. It's from 1950. It's 2 minutes and 58 seconds long on this version. I hope you're enjoying this transmission of Cage Stripes on Kill Radio.
Was required by his mother-in-law to set out on a journey to an island beneath the sea and to bring back some golden apples he would find there. Should he fail to return within a year, he would lose his right to the throne, relinquishing it to one of his stepbrothers. For his journey, he was given a miserable shaggy nag. No sooner had he set out than the nag said, "Look in my ear, you will find a metal ball. Throw it on the path ahead of us, and we will follow it wherever it goes." Unhesitatingly, the prince did this. And so, proceeding by chance, they passed through many perilous situations. Finally, on the point of success, the horse said to the prince, "Now take your sword and slit my throat." The prince hesitated, but only for a moment. No sooner had he killed the horse than, lo and behold, it turned into a prince who, except for the acquiescence of the hero, would have had to remain a miserable, shaggy nag. Schoenberg always complained that his American pupils didn't do enough work. There was one girl in the class, in particular, who, it is true, did almost no work at all. He asked her one day why she didn't accomplish more. She said, "I don't have any time."